The Angie's List you know and trust is now Angie, and we're so much more than just a list. We still connect you with top local pros and show you ratings and reviews, but now we also let you compare upfront prices on hundreds of projects and book a service instantly. We can even handle the rest of your project from start to finish. So remember, Angie's List is now Angie, and we're here to get your job done right. Get started at Angie.com. That's A-N-G-I, or download the app today.
Rally Pod at your service, and finally we have got the band back together. It feels like forever. So much has happened and not happened since we last hit record, so I think we should pretty much get straight to it. I'm Lisa O'Sullivan, a suffering from cabin fever rally fan. In the blue corner, punching above his weight, we've got the man they call the voice of rally, Colin Clark. Good morning, Colin.
Morning, Lisa. Nice to hear your voice again.
Thank you. In the red corner, he's been there. He's done it. He's run the teams. It's former motorsport director George Donaldson. Morning, George.
Good morning, Lisa. Good morning, everyone. I feel like a boxer. Yeah. I feel like I'm out boxing then.
Well, I'll add, this is going to be a very crowded ring, because in the grey and golden orange dirtfish corner office with a view is senior staff writer David Evans.
Good morning. David. Good morning. How are we?
I should add now that I actually have a dirtfish t-shirt.
Oh.
Yay. Wow. Yeah. Oh. Yay. I'm very happy.
How comes he's gone and I haven't?
That's because I had to go on a camera in Turkey.
That was Colin's job to send you yours.
Yeah, at least I might have some for you, actually. I might well have some for you.
And it'll be the same story next year. He will have some for you next year as well, Lisa. Yeah.
But what I do have, Lisa, what I do have for you is a rather nice baseball cap, which I'm sure you'll wear rather well.
Ah, I like the sound of that. Do you know, it's like I'm just getting to know you guys for the first time, because it feels so long since we last made a podcast.
It was ages ago, wasn't it?
Altogether, anyway.
Yeah, but it's been. We've got to say, there is not a good reason at all for us not making podcasts. But the fact that we have gone back to rallying, if there ever was a good reason, perhaps that is that good reason. Is it? Or is that quite
absolutely
convoluted?
David? No, that's absolutely it. Action before words, and words are a good second best. And in this case, we'd like to say, I'm sure, about ourselves, but. If we've got rallying, let's be covering that. Come on, that's where the story
absolutely.
Is.
Absolutely. But do you know what the best part, George? The best part of the last few months has been actually seeing you out on event again. And anyone that follows our videos online on the wonderful Dirtfish YouTube channel have seen George in Turkey. George, it was great to have you as part of the team in Turkey.
I had a fabulous time. I really, really enjoyed myself with you guys. What a fantastic rally. I mean, Turkey just gave us what World Rally Championship should be about. Unbelievably testing, unbelievably difficult, unpredictable, there's the big word. And it gave us a great result, really. I think it's been a fabulous event. And for my money, very, very worthy of inclusion in the World Championship. A great event.
So what do we say, George? Let's jump in right there. What do we say to the people in the championship who said that there is no place now for events like Turkey, like Safari? These cars are not built for them. You know, they're going through too many front splitters. It's costing too much. You know, we're all about smooth gravel now.
Well, hang on. The argument basically is don't break your cars in rallying.
Come on.
Yeah, that's kind of what that's kind of what some people are advocating. And I noticed there was some fans also, one or two, didn't like the fact that the rallies were a bit rough and tough. I hasten to add that we drove road cars over those stages. We're not talking; these were not tank testingly rough roads. But they were hard, and they had that hard base rock character, and they're not well formed macadam roads because there's no need for them in that environment. Is there no need for them? I mean, are we just going to go to asphalt? I dare say it's the powers that be that will decide that. Let's be honest, some of the most spectacular rallying and views we get are on gravel rallies, really, to my mind. The most spectacular part of our sport is generally on gravel, on loose surfaces.
Do you know what I found interesting, George? What was interesting, as you said, we drove quite a number of those stages, and we drove that decisive stage in Turkey, didn't we, that stage 9, and you absolutely called it. you know, a lot of the talk was about the inequity of the situation with the dust. But at the end of the day, it wasn't the dust that gave us the problems in that stage, was it? You might argue the dust maybe hampered vision, which then, you know, caused drivers to take excessive cuts, which then meant they picked up punctures. But, you know, the thing with that stage was that the driver who approached it in the best way got through the stage, and that was Elvin Evans without any problems. So, you know, I don't buy the criticism of places like Turkey and Safari and, at some degree, Acropolis. I don't buy it at all. I think it's part of the DNA of rallying. It's a different challenge. It requires a different mindset, a different approach, and it gives us what rallying's all about. It gives us that unpredictability and that diversity that we need. If we're talking about, you know, let's split it 50% between smooth gravel rallies and tarmac rallies, wow, gee whiz, we might as well go circuit racing. You know, we need that diversity, don't we? And we got that in Turkey, and I thought it was fabulous.
For me, the balance was just absolutely perfect there. And I mean, but I do get what people are saying. They don't want to see car-breakingly tough events. I mean, if it becomes a massive cost issue about splitters, FIA can just rule a splitter height. You know, there's a rule there that says you can't have a splitter. The splitter can't be any closer than, say, you know, at 180 millimetres from the ground, the front splitter, and I don't know, the same on the back as well, you know.
Wasn't there also some talk about maybe homologating a cheaper splitter or something for certain rallies? Wasn't there talk of that for a while?
You know, Toyota, they split their splitter, if you like, didn't they? Because it was one unit in 17, and they were breaking quite a few of them. So obviously, when they broke the whole thing, it cost quite a lot to produce another one. So they then, I think they made it in sections and re-homologated it. I can't remember, but you know, I completely agree about this whole point of rough rallies. And you know, one thing it does produce, and one thing that it does give us, is a more rounded driver. You know, this at this time of the year, 25 years ago, we were all talking about Colin McRae and the potential for him winning a world championship. You know, everybody knew about Colin McRae's speed and how quickly he could drive a rally car. But one aspect of him that people didn't know, and really that really added so much to his character and his ability as a driver, was how he could drive rough rallies. And he could drive them as slowly as was necessary to win. You know, we saw him do it on Safari, on Acropolis. Drivers, we're in danger if we don't have these events of having drivers who don't have the ability to drive essentially with their head, which is what Elvin did on that final day. You know, I'm not saying that everybody else went was gung-ho and attacked too hard and got themselves punctures, but perhaps Elvin had a bit more of a plan to drive around stuff, if you could. And again, it's very easy for me to sit here and blindly say these things, but you've got to have that ability to sort of throttle back and see the bigger picture of the whole event. And for me, that's what we need. We need to have these drivers who have almost the kind of common sense of driving a rough gravel rally.
But the disappointing thing is, David, that, you know, okay, I think there's... Turkey's on the calendar with an asterisk for next year, is that right? But
yes.
You know, the talk that we heard as we left Turkey was that, well, we won't be coming back here for quite some time, which was a big disappointment to you and I, George, because we found a really good restaurant, didn't we?
It was fabulous. Absolutely fantastic.
I have to say as well, though, the other argument for rough rallies is the way they sell the sport. As a spectator from home, as I am, and, you know, you only have to talk to someone like Colin... I want to say Colin McMaster. Yeah, Colin McMaster. You know, the photographs and the cameras and the drones and the helicopter shots we get of a gravel rally are always more spectacular than watching a car going along a tarmac surface. It really sells the sport.
You get great photographs in Monty, but you could actually have the car static for a lot of the photographs. There's not a lot of motion in it, is there, really, on asphalt? Generally, obviously, because the drivers are trying to make sure the car doesn't unstick. So it's. I'm not saying it's boring. Far from boring. It's incredibly special to get to be there and see the speed, and the videos that we see are fantastic. And unless you're driving Gigi Galli in a group N car coming into hairpins backwards at like 50 miles an hour on a hairpin and somehow getting round it, it's not got some of that spectacle. It's a different spectacle, I think, is probably what you'd say. But
But for me, it's the variety, George.
That was exactly the reason, though, wasn't it, George, why back in 2001, 2 or 3, where David Richards essentially wanted to really limit the amount of tarmac rallies we had in the championships. It's why we moved to Sardinia and away from San Remo, because he felt that there was too much tarmac and that, you know, exactly what you said there, there's not enough spectacle on the tarmac. Quick point of order, Cole. Turkey is one of the events, essentially, that's on the bench for next year.
On the bench, along with
Latvia and Monza, Acropolis, Argentina, I think, as well. It's not in the calendar, but it is potentially in the calendar. But it's essentially, who knows what a calendar is for next year anyway.
But listen, if we did lose Turkey, you know, in the past we've had Cyprus, we've had Acropolis, we've had Safari, obviously. You know, if we did lose Turkey, and as you say, it is there, but it's there as a reserve, if you like, isn't it, David, I suppose? You know, in terms of rough rallies, we're looking around saying, well, we don't really have one, but I suppose the encouraging news that's come out in the last couple of months, guys, and I know it's one of your favourites, George, is that there's a massive push in Greece to get the Acropolis back into the WRC. And it's, you know, we hear it from time to time, and I think it was 2002, I would say many, many years ago. Was it 12, the last time we were in Greece?
Yeah.
Something like that. And we've heard it in the intervening years, or they're trying to negotiate to get back into the calendar, and it's always just kind of frazzled out, hasn't it, before it's got anywhere. But this time it's different. This time it's got the backing of the government. It's got the backing of the sports ministry. There is apparently, I'm told, there's money that's been made available for it. And so maybe if we do lose Turkey, maybe, quite strangely, you know, Turkey going might be the opportunity for the Acropolis to be revived. And that would be no bad thing.
Well, there's a whole load of politics there, isn't
there?
Greece and Turkey. Let's
not unpack that one.
I'm sure it's nothing to do with either country. It's just rallying has always transcended all that type of politics.
Yeah,
unfortunately, we're sort of dipping our toes into politics these days because of the amount of money that's required to run a WRC event. And also, obviously, at this particular time, we have to lean on the authorities to get the approvals to be there via the COVID restrictions. So,
David, you've mentioned what we've got kind of bench-wise next year. It might be worth just spelling out how are things looking for next year, regardless of the COVID situation. If looking at the penciled in, the crossed out, the I've got that one down in ink calendar for 2021. Where are we at with that at the moment before we finish 2020?
Well, in an ordinary world, if we even remember what an ordinary world is, I actually had a text last night from Andrew Kellett, the route coordinator from Rally GB. and AK was saying last night, very strange feelings today, because obviously the day that we are recording this, Tuesday, should have been the start of the recce for Wales Rally GB. So it's very odd. But anyway, sorry, back to your point, Lise. We have obviously Monty in January, then Sweden, February. So perfectly normal start to the year. We're then off to Croatia, fingers crossed. Portugal, Italy, Safari in June. So we still have that rough element in there. Estonia in July, Finland back to its usual date in end of July, early August. Obviously without the backing of Neste for next year. And then an interesting one, we have Rally GB / Northern Ireland in the middle of August, Chile in September, Spain in October, usual date for Spain, and Japan in November, essentially in the date that it would have been next month, so postponed from next month to a year in next month. And then on the subs list, we have Turkey, Latvia, Belgium, Argentina, Greece, and Monza. But again, you know, those are the ones. But, you know, how can we talk about really anything? You were supposed to be off to Ypres, and fingers crossed, you know, one thing that I would like to get across in this podcast is just how much I am desperate to go to Ypres. You know, I've talked in the past about it not being my favourite rally for whatever reason.
There's a big U-turn there, David.
I know. But I think, you know, the thing, my issue a little bit with Ypres is that I always found it a bit predictable in June. It would always be, you knew what you were going to get. But my goodness me, you know, Ypres in this November,
I was sent a picture from one of the stages for Ypres, and it was taken at the weekend, so 4 or 5 days ago. And they were just, you could see over to the, so the picture was, the stage was growing up the centre of the picture, and over to the left, you could see that the farmers had just, they'd just harvested whatever was in their field. And honestly, you couldn't tell that this was a tarmac section of road. There was so much mud on it. There was so much mud. Now, this is the beginning of the harvesting season. By the time we get another 3 or 4 weeks down the line, we are right in the middle of the harvesting and the preparation, preparing the fields. And it was awful.
Exactly. You say it's awful, and immediately we'll have people jumping on the bandwagon saying, it's not safe, we've got to stop it, this madness. Nonsense.
Absolutely.
What I mean, George, I remember years and years ago, and we would all remember the year that Rally GB had to stop its some the Sweet Lamb stages in the snow and the ice. Was that in 2008 or something?
Auger's first year.
Oh, yeah, exactly. So I think it was 2008, something like that. Yeah. But yeah. I had to interview Max Mosley later that year, and I was talking to him about this whole debacle, about what had gone on. And he said, you know, I didn't really understand that, he said, because presumably the argument was from the leading crews that they couldn't possibly get through the stage. It was unsafe. And Mosley said, it wasn't unsafe. They could absolutely get through that stage. You know, on winter tyres, on road tyres, you could get through that stage. And that's the point, isn't it? You know, the drivers will play this safety card when actually it's a performance card. You know, they won't be able to drive the cars as quickly as they want.
Yeah.
It's an unbelievably partisan subject, this safety card. Now, you know, I'm a big fan of Thierry, as you know, Thierry Neuville, but he talks about this safety card with a degree of disregard, which I find, not disregard, he utilises it with a disregard for some of the other things he does. You know, he drives in Monte Carlo Rally, he'll drive in Corsica Rally and not mention the safety. My goodness gracious, in Monte Carlo, honestly? I think, but to come away from the fact that drivers will use that, I mean, and I'm only using Thierry as an example, you know, all the drivers will do it. All the drivers are very vocal about a subject that they get close to. And it's very, very hard to argue against any safety considerations. And only a fool would sit there and say that's absolute nonsense. Certainly at the time, because you could be setting yourself up for, you know, a very serious personal mistake. But also, you know, you're then perhaps putting people in harm's way. Not a smart thing. But this is motorsport, so we've got to actually take a kind of careful measure when we use that safety word. I think the bottom line is, I think it's used with a degree of abandon, as you said, David, to suit the performance advantages and disadvantages that a circumstance may reveal. But the bottom line is that rallying has changed, whether we like it or not at the moment, constantly, hopefully, will continue to change and develop and meet the whatever requirements. But the bottom line is, yeah, you could have done all those stages. You just need to have the right tyres on. We've got a ridiculous set of tyre restrictions right now. It's getting worse and worse and worse, the restrictions. We're now down to one make of tyre to take away that partisan option that, you know, the Pirellis will be better in wet mud and maybe the Michelins are better on, you know, dry or tricky asphalt. You know, actually, no, Pirellis actually, historically, you know, the people have had advantages and disadvantages. And they play out as an interesting part of the competition. But people always feel that they've got a dice loaded against them or for them. If it's for them, they say, no, we've not got any advantages, but against them, they want a stage cancelled because it doesn't suit them. I, as a team manager, have worked very hard to make sure stages aren't cancelled, because I've sent my cars out on wet tyres or intermediates with cuts when everyone else has gone on a slick. And I've invested in a good weather forecast, and we've gone up to a stage start. And I knew that the weather was coming. Nobody else seemed to have figured it out because they didn't organise a good weather forecast. And immediately, the other team managers were on the phone to the clerk of the course, telling them this stage is dangerous and you've got to cancel it and everyone's on slick tyres and it'll be a disaster. And I've been sitting there with the clerk of the course in Corsica when those phone calls came in. And I've already told him he's going to get those phone calls. And I've got two cars sitting on intermediates. And I want the stage to run. And he doesn't want his rally being cancelled, so the stage ran. But, you know, so people will play that partisan card. Maybe the thing to do is to, you know, why on a snowy REC rally, you know, or on any REC rally in November, why have we not got a contingency for... For winter tyres?
Wow. Well, we have that for Monte, not for Monte, sorry. We have that for Ypres, don't we? For Ypres, you see that there's a third choice.
They've got gravel tyres.
Yeah.
Well, they've gone with the Monte tyre.
It's a monsoon tyre, essentially, isn't it? They're very soft compound.
And people are saying, well, it's unlikely it's going to snow. That choice is not for the snow. That choice, I suspect,
is for the mud.
The excessive mud that will... Almost certainly, it's not even an outside chance. That mud will almost certainly be there and will play a major part in the rally. So they've given themselves that extra option. But I suppose the question is it going to be enough? Well, it is enough, and you have to deal with it. You know, we know the mud's going to be there.
Can you imagine the tyre choices, Colin? We're going to see crossed. Someone will be running one mud tyre, one slick, and one hard and one soft. What a mess it's going to be.
But this is the joy of Ypres, George.
It's a great competition, particularly,
as you come in through the fields, it's muddy. As I say, it looks like in places, a gravel or a mud road. You come out into the more open areas and it could easily be bone dry. And you only have to look at they ran a rally the same week as Sardinia in Belgium. And you only had to look at that rally. There was some fantastic drone footage. And you could see the cars coming out from the trees. It was soaking wet. They were into the cuts. There was mud for 500-600 metres. Then it was bone dry for another 500-600 metres. Yeah. And then you were back into full wet and full mud. And for me, that's what really... there's two things that make Ypres really exciting. The fact that, you take out the boys that have been there before, but from a WRC perspective, it's a level playing field. And then we have this, it's Ypres at a new time of year. And for me, I'm keeping everything crossed that it runs. And there's been some slightly disappointing news this morning about some stages in France that were due to run as part of the rally that have been cancelled. So, let's just hope that that's all that we get in terms of cancellations. But it's potentially going to be the most exciting rally of the year. And fingers crossed we go.
What I love about Ypres is the margin of error is so small for the drivers with those culverts on the side of the road. The amount of cars that will have a slow off, but the rally's over because they're parked up in one of those concrete culverts on the side of the road.
It's basically the asphalt equivalent of what Kielder used to be, Lisa. Kielder has an innocuous-looking ditch at the side of the road. It's actually 2 metres across and 3 metres deep. Yeah. Everywhere,
and
it's
full of
mud. And
have you been in some of those ditches, George?
I the very first time I was in Kielder, I came out of a hairpin and just let the car slip just very, very slightly wide. I was going slowly because I had about a 5 or 6 minute lead in Group N, and I think I was lying in the top 10 in my second ever rally in a proper good car. I mean, I'd been driving Minis and little Fiestas before, and all of a sudden I was on this Sierra Cosworth.
And wasn't this George when it was on maps?
There was no pace notes. It was just maps. It just came out. Look, it was an open hairpin. You could see. I just drove around this hairpin and I came into it reasonably nicely, just because it's a hairpin and you want to. And I got the hairpin very nicely. And I was just literally driving out the corner. And I can't remember why. I was a bit lazy with the steering. I just let the car slip a little bit wide. And there was no reason to do it. I mean, I could have moved the car to the right. I could have gone off on the inside just about as easily. And the car just slipped off I wasn't going fast. It was literally just exiting the hairpin. And one wheel fell off. You looked at the car, you thought it would have driven away. But it was bellied.
But here's the other thing, there were
spectators, but nobody could get to the car, to the back side of the car or the inside of the car, because the ditch was too deep.
But George, this is going to be another thing about Ypres this year, is from what we're hearing, because obviously Belgium is really having it tough right now with this second wave of COVID. We're hearing that one of the measures will be no spectators. Now, during a normal Ypres, if you go off, chances are you're going to get back on again. There are plenty of spectators there to help you out. There'll be no spectators. There's all these ditches, all this mud, all of this great unknown. No spectators. Mm. It is going to be, and fingers crossed as it runs, it's going to be a fantastically exciting event. But you have to say, I don't know what the odds are just now, but we'll keep our fingers crossed.
This is the point, isn't it? There's been so many changes, and talking to people yesterday, it's changing not by the day, but by the hour. Yeah. And it's, on dirtfish.com, we've tried to step back from writing, just about every turn of what's happening, because we've got to, at some point, just sort of settle down and just say, okay, let's give the organisers time, let's give the FIA and the promoter time, just to figure out what can be done here. But it is, it's just the most difficult job to organise a rally right now. You look to beyond Ypres, and we're going to, touch wood, hopefully, we're going to Monza, back to Italy. But, to consider going into the Lombardy region right now is difficult again.
But David, what was interesting, David, is that we actually got confirmation. I think it was in a meeting that you had with the FIA that, whatever happens now, we have a championship, if you like. Yeah. The sale is on. The game is on. We're live. So the leaderboard right now, and I'm sure it's absolutely not what anyone would want, but if we did lose Ypres and we didn't get to Monza, Elvin Evans is a legitimate world rally champion.
I asked Elvin exactly about that and said, how do you feel? And he, obviously he wants to do a complete season. But quite rightly, Elvin said, if it is just these six rallies, we've all had the same chance.
Correct.
We've all had those same six rallies. And essentially, why shouldn't there be a champion? And he's dead right.
We've had this gap since we've done the last podcast. Can we perhaps go back to the restart, as it were, and assess how things have gone since we did manage to get the rallies back underway? Because so much has happened since our last podcast. It really does almost feel like a different lifetime ago. We have got to the point where we do have a championship. We do have potentially a valid and legitimate world champion in Elvin Evans. How do you think the sport has managed to get itself back up and running?
That has to start with Estonia, who did the most remarkable job. These people, was it 63 days or something? They created a WRC round. In February this year, Rally Estonia was off. And then there was this chance of coming to WRC, so they recreated the event in 63 days. Not only did they create a great WRC round, they've created what has so far been the benchmark WRC round in the COVID era, because for me, they did a better job than certainly Turkey did and Sardinia did in terms of keeping everybody apart, 100%. Testing, and just the whole, that you felt that you were, in an event that had been running for years and years. And it was incredible. And to start there was it set the bar very, very high for the returning events.
And, some people have worked remarkably hard, haven't they? And I think, Estonia, as you say, they didn't just set the benchmark in terms of, when you're a new event coming into the calendar, you have blueprints, don't you, for really everything that you should do now. They had a blueprint, Estonia, but they chucked that blueprint out the window because it really didn't apply. Theirs was a completely new environment they were coming into, and they created the blueprint, and I thought it was really quite a remarkable effort. But people worked really, really hard, and you have to give credit to the FIA, and it's easy to knock the FIA, but they kept all their options open. They kept negotiating, they kept talking, they kept offering up solutions rather than potential problems. There were solutions there. There was help to find those solutions. And I guess you have to kind of say that the promoter also played its part in all of that. And it, for me, at least, it was tenacity and hard work that got us back up rallying again. Now, there were grumbles. There were grumbles we left it too late. You know, when were we in Estonia? It was the second week in September. And I think a lot of people were saying, look at Formula One, look at the motorbikes, look at touring cars. They've all been running right through August.
It was going to be difficult, wasn't it? Because we could never really see Finland happening.
No.
You know, commercially, Finland was a very difficult one. So then there was nothing else in August. But then we had this opportunity of Latvia. But one of the teams was not keen. Hyundai didn't really want to go to Latvia. They weren't ready for whatever reason. There were some cynical sorts that said that perhaps Hyundai didn't want to go to another fast gravel rally. But actually, as it played out in Estonia, that was completely wrong because they've clearly fixed their car in terms of fast gravel rallies. And we saw, you know, a result and the emotions of a result that was absolutely befitting the hard work that all of the Estonians have put in when Ott Tänak won that event. And that was, you know, it was a fabulous moment for the country. But to come back to the development of Elvin's season, you know, he went there on the back of a pretty sizable shunt on that warm-up rally. What was it? The Luna Estu rally, wasn't it? Just a couple of weeks before. And finished fourth. And it was really Elvin's season has been built around two wins. You know, the win in terms of absolute speed in Sweden and then the perhaps more tactical win in Turkey. And then he struggled in Sardinia first on the road. And finished fourth, but he's at the top of the tree right now and deserves to be there. He's the only driver across the season that's won twice.
You would compare him with Juha Kankkonen, David, wouldn't you, Colin? You would, because Juha was the ultimate survivor. He won when it was possible, and he got those seconds, thirds, fourths to get championships.
What Elvin's done as well, boys and Lise, he set himself up beautifully for Ypres, because Ypres, the place you want to be, first on the road, no question. It'll rapidly deteriorate. Yeah,
normally.
Rapidly deteriorate. And he sets himself up beautifully.
He does. And let's not forget, you know, while he's never been there and he's never done Ypres, he is remarkably, remarkably good on tarmac, as we saw in Corsica all those years ago, and as we always would see in Germany.
And do you know what, David? Do you know what one of his real strengths is? His real strength is reading the road. He can pick surface changes, grip changes, really on what he's seeing. You know, a lot of drivers have to wait till they feel it in the steering, they feel it under braking. He picks it on what he sees, and he is remarkably good at that. And that, you know, it's going to be one of those attributes that you will need in Ypres, because there will be surface changes all the time, and it will be that ability to read those changes that stands you in good stead. I think he's in a great position, and I think he's very lucky in that, you know, the hype in the UK hasn't really started, and I really do hope it does start. You know, I think he's got to be our favourite to win the championship. But when I say I hope it starts, it's not that I hope he wins. I think he will win. I just hope that we see the UK media, the UK sporting media, getting behind Elvin Evans, because right now it's actually not a bad thing that they're not, because it takes the pressure off him, takes the expectation off him. But, you know, if he does achieve something that nobody saw coming at the start of the year, I don't care what you say, no one thought that Elvin Evans was going to be world champion this year. If he does manage to achieve that, he deserves, you know, everything that we can possibly throw at him, because it'll be a...
Sports personality of the year, Cole?
Well, you know,
massively,
we've been ignored, haven't we? You know,
yeah,
we've been ignored by sports personality. You know, Malcolm Wilson did some remarkable things in the past two or three years, particularly in 2017 when he won the driver's title and the manufacturer's title. And, you know, he was ignored by the UK sporting press. And it shows, sadly, where rallying in the UK had come in the intervening, 16 years, 17 years since we last had a world champion. You know, it was back page news. It was on all the radio, the national radio sports bulletins, the TV bulletins. It's not anymore, but that's partly our job to try and, you know, we can be the cheerleaders. We can be the rah-rah boys, can't we? As best we can.
Yeah. Yeah. No, you're right. And you know, I think you're absolutely right in that he would deserve it. You know, when you look back to Monty and he led Monty for so long and could easily have won that event. He set his stall out very early and he's there. But talking to Elvin about Ypres, and I was asking him, how do you feel about all of this indecision about are we going, are we not? He said, I want to go. I want to go because, you know, it's for all of the reasons we've talked about there, it's an exciting event. And, you know, fundamentally, he's a sportsman who wants to perform in his sport.
Yeah, it's exciting. Listen, can I move us on to something else I wanted to talk about? And that I've and David's already written about it in a really interesting opinion piece. And I think by the time you hear this, my piece will be up as well. What I noticed, you know, it really struck home in for some reason in Sardinia. I don't know whether I was maybe listening to more stage end stuff, but George, you know, you've been to a few stage ends. I've been to a lot of stage ends, and I was really, really disappointed at the lack of information, the lack of communication at stage ends. And okay, I get it. I get things have changed this year. I get that the time card protocols have changed, and you know, maybe drivers they can move off at their own free will. When, you know, in the good old days when we were doing radio and the rest, George, we had time to interrogate, to interview, to really delve deep into what the drivers had done, what they were thinking. And I get that maybe that's moved on a little bit, but you know, I fear that as things progress, you know, in everyday life, in sport, and everything, you know, and we're finding these new normals, that a silent stage end, we're heading towards that. Drivers are becoming less communicative. You know, what we're hearing from the stage ends is not as enlightening as it used to be. It's not as entertaining as it used to be. And I don't know, is it just me that's you know, maybe I'm hypercritical because I spent so many years at the stage end, but is it just me that's picking up on that, boys?
Before you jump in,
yes,
George,
it's just you, Colin.
I'm wondering if this is the way that technology's moved on, because going back to the radio days, in those times, quite often the teams were finding out information at the same time as the rest of us. Now, you know, they can send a text, they'll be on the mobile, whatever, the information can get back to the teams in a different way. But before, the drivers were using the radio to communicate with everybody, not just the listeners. You know, they weren't just doing it for entertainment, they were quite often giving information back to their team as well. Is that possibly part of the change?
Well, I think it is.
People are scared to give it. You know, if a driver has a problem, they want to conceal it from the other teams, because if there's another two stages, you don't want to give away anything. So the idea is that you move away and you don't reveal how big your problem is, because if you can actually conceal that you've got a problem, your opposing drivers will go into the next stage still fighting like crazy and maybe make a mistake and have a puncture or even stop. So that's the sporting advantage that they're not wanting to give away.
Yeah, but George, you, there was the complete opposite was done in the past as well. You know, drivers would say things, and there were one or two that were notorious for it. They would make things up, you know, because they knew that the other teams were listening, that it would get reported back to whoever they were battling against.
It's such a shame that people aren't playing those silly little games. And I mean, you know, the one guy that would be utterly brilliant at that would be Ott Tanak. You know, how good would Ott Tanak be at playing a straight card? Because the guy's just, you know, his poker face is his only face. You know, the guy, you wouldn't play poker with Ott Tanak. You'd lose every time, you know. You'd lose at the deal. You'd just give him the money. You know, the guy would be brilliant. So, yeah, a few more games like that would be fun, and people are missing a little trick there. I'm liking that idea, Colin. I'm feeling filled with nonsense now hearing this.
Ogier, occasionally you'd not want to play poker with him, but those times, Colin, that he would come to the end of the stage fuming about something, and you'd be going, he's not talking. Oh, something's not right. And that would say so much as well, because it's like, why isn't he saying? Why is he walking around the car?
I really remember, Lise, it really scared me. It was Monte Carlo. It was the year he was battling with Loeb. What year was that, where we had that incredible opening stage in the dark from Loeb? I can't remember which stage it was. It was this Friday stage. It was the one just before lunch. But it was 3 or 4, and he came to the stage end. And I think he was first on the road, and Sebastian was about 11th or 12th on the road. So, you know, by the time that Ogier had got to us, Loeb hadn't actually started the stage. And I think it was Julian Porter asked him a question, and he was about to answer it, and he looked over his shoulder, and he could see me standing there with my microphone, and he went, "He is here. I am not answering if he is here," pointing at me. I'm thinking, what have I done? What have I done? What have I done? What have I done? And I'm racking my brain thinking, did I criticise him somewhere? Did I say something about him that maybe's been misinterpreted? So I went to find him in service at the end of the day, and I said, look, Seb, have you got a second? He went, yeah. I said, look, I'm really sorry. Did I say something that upset you? And he looked at me in a strange way, and he didn't register. And I went, at the end of that stage where you looked at me and said, I'm not answering if he's here. He went, no. He said, no, nothing to do with you. But I knew that Citroën were listening in. I knew that Loeb hadn't started, and I didn't want to say anything. I didn't want to give Citroën any kind of advantage. Those were the great stories, the great days of you know, stage ends where there was proper drama. And what I feel about what drivers are what we're missing, with these silent stage ends, and they are almost silent at times, and it frustrates the hell out of me. But we are missing that real sense of entertainment. And it's something that is completely unique about our sport. And do you know what I was thinking the other day? When did it start? When did this tradition of driver interviews at stage end start? Because it's not anything you see in any other sport. And I suspect it may have been back to the days of the Pattersons with their wonderful, their updates from the stage ends. May even have been before that, you know. But it's something that's established in rallying, that, and we all know why it's established, because up until 10 or 15 years ago, nobody knew what was going on in the stages. And unless the drivers told you at the stage end, you would have to wait practically all day until the information got back. But, you know, we have that unique ability to speak to the drivers the second they come out of stages. It's established. And for me, it would be a crying shame if we allowed that wonderful, unique access that we've all enjoyed over the years, if we allowed that just to disappear and allowed drivers not to speak to us and give us those exchanges at stage ends.
I think we are, you know, it's fair to say that we are in a different set of circumstances now, aren't we? You, Cole, you and George, and, you know, me to a much smaller extent, we know how difficult it is to interview these people, and especially when you're trying to do it. Not that it's difficult to interview them, but when you're doing it on the end of a meter or 2 meter long pole, and you can't really hear what they're saying back to you. It's not the easiest. And perhaps, you know, we need some technology that the interviewers potentially can be better informed, because we've talked about this before, that they don't seem to know if in the last, say, K there's been a, or last couple of K there's been an issue for the car. They're not aware of that. And, you know, that's the thing that's at the forefront of the driver's mind when they're coming in to talk about it. And if they're not asked about it, it's just the whole interview seems strange. But it is difficult, the job that they're doing right now.
I agree with that. You know, it's as hard as it's ever been, and I totally agree that there's all sorts of circumstances. But my point is that I wouldn't like to see, you know, that there's a lot of things that we used to do before this global pandemic that won't return, in our day-to-day lives and in our sports
this
lives,
will.
And our professional
this,
lives.
Absolutely, this will.
Well, I hope
it has
so.
To. Because, you know, this is so much part. It's where we find the character of the drivers, and it's where we tell much of the story. And, you know, you referenced, you know, the piece that I wrote about Wojciech Tanak. And for me, the attitude that Tanak takes is part of that story. And somebody pointed out on social media that, you know, Stig Blomqvist would have been exactly the same. For perhaps a different reason, he was a very shy character and didn't always have a lot to say. You have these kind of loquacious drivers who will talk for hours and about everything, you know, the Petter Solbergs of it as well, who are tremendously entertaining. But to balance that, you do need people, for me, you do need people like Oit, who, you know, wears his heart absolutely firmly on his sleeve. And he's under no obligation. You know, if the thing that got me a little bit is that he did open the door. He did say, I've got a suspension problem, I'm away. And then for the stages after that, he didn't open the door. He'd got a suspension problem, you know, and he hadn't had the ability at that point to download any data to discover, you know, for sure, we could have asked him more. We could have asked him, you know, what's the car doing? How's it reacting? You know, what have you been able to do between the stages? If he'd opened the door, but, you know, it wasn't like he left us uninformed. He told us what the problem was. And after that, you know, he just didn't want to open the door. And you could understand that. He'd lost so much time as a driver. He'd lost his chance of winning the event. Yeah, but you know,
his chance of the championship was slipping from his grasp. Some fairly heavy emotions in at that moment, I imagine.
And what we did miss, what we really, really should have tried to do there is interview these boys on the road section. Because, you know, for sure, Oit would have stopped not far down the road after every stage to look at what else he could do. And talking to him afterwards, we know that he did. We know that he worked on the car. And that's my frustration in this current kind of COVID era, that we're all very, very aware of what we can and can't do. And for very justifiable and understandable reasons, we're not allowed to approach the crews out on the road section. But if we could have done, you know, we could perhaps have got a little bit more of the story. I'm not saying that Oit would have told us anything necessarily that he wouldn't have told anybody else.
We've kind of gone a bit full circle, though, with this, going back to what we were talking about at the beginning of this podcast about the colour and the energy that the gravel stages bring to the championship. The stage ends also give us a glimpse into the character of the drivers. And if just looking at the beautiful, you know, stock photographs that are taken by the teams, they just become a cardboard cutout of someone who gets in a car and drives. We love this sport because we learn so much about the individuals who are wrestling with the car, either because of the conditions or because there's a problem, or for whatever reason. When we get that glimpse into the car at the end of the stages, we are seeing a sportsman or woman bearing their soul and telling us exactly how they've done their job to actually get to the end of the stage.
That's brilliantly put. That is one of the biggest benefits of stage ends and stage end interviews, is that you see the true characters. I couldn't agree with you more. I'm not going to add anything more to that because you've put it brilliantly. The point is, you know, let's do what we have to do to get through this remarkably difficult period. But the first thing we do when we get out of this silliness is we reintroduce proper stage ends, proper stage end interviews.
It is. I mean, the thing is, though, that drivers otherwise, if you're not watching that, then you have an image of a driver with their folded arms standing like a cardboard cutout, because that's all you see of them. You see the fantastic shots of the cars going through the stages, but you don't necessarily, and that is the privilege that we have in our sport, that we have such great access to drivers and co-drivers and team bosses and mechanics and engineers who are all so passionate about what they're doing, whether it's the service, the 20-minute service of getting a car turned around, watching the crews work on the cars, you see the passion going back in there as well. And all of that becomes very sterile if we don't get to experience it or show it to fans who can't and increasingly will be looking to experience it online or, you know, through video or, you know, some lucky people that do still have radio stations running and covering events.
It's absolutely right, that, Lisa, because if you think, you know, you look at Formula One, you look at other aspects of motorsport, there's this almost this kind of decompression chamber, isn't there, where the driver comes in, he doesn't have any media commitments until he's taken his helmet off, he's had a bottle of water and he's calmed himself down. And, you know, for Formula One, that it's a good sort of 5 minutes before they talk and do a piece to camera. But for us, literally, the minute... Yeah, absolutely, absolutely. The minute for us they're over the line, you know, it's the media that are first in there. And at the minute, perhaps we're not exploiting that in the way that, for the reasons that we've already discussed. But you were dead right there, Lisa. And Colin, you know, you were quite right as well, that look at places like, I referred to this in my piece about Tanak in Poland, when he lost the chance of that first win. And, you know, it was just those two words. You know, he just said it's too much and drove away. And increasingly in the last couple of years, the guy that gave us so much emotion was people like, it was Jari Mäntylä in Sardinia last year. Remember when he rolled?
Yeah.
And oh, my goodness me. He was incredible. Absolutely amazing. And to lose that ability to capture those emotions would be an absolute crime. But anyway, we're arguing a moot point here because we won't. It's what so much of our sport is based around.
Fabulous. Good to hear.
Well, that is our time up, pretty much. We've managed to keep that nicely concise to our 45-minute guideline. Any other business? Is there anything anybody else needs to mention before we go away, make a plan about the next time the band's going to get back together?
See you at Christmas.
Yeah.
Lisa, I have one thing to raise. Is your 45 minutes seems to be 49 minutes. Just so you're patting yourself on the back for keeping it there. You didn't. So I don't think you're that good.
I was kind of just fudging it a bit. But by the time I've edited some bits out, it'll be.
Oh yeah, yeah. That's me out.
No, George, that'd be 22 minutes then, and that's not enough.
Oh Jesus. I've lost out.
Oh, well, I've really enjoyed this. I feel like I'm back in the sports, having watched the pictures and stuff, but talking about it just makes it so much more fun. And I really, really hope that we'll have another podcast soon to talk about more rally action before we get to the end of this. Such a strange...
We've got a huge... The Ypres is going to... working on the basis that Ypres is going to run, which a lot of people seem very determined that it will, which it seems unimaginable, but fantastic that they're so determined and they're going to go ahead with it. There's a huge amount to talk about the strategies and tactics that can play out for that event. I want to have that conversation, guys.
Do you know what I want to do? Here's something we're going to do, right, for our pre-Ypres podcast. We're going to have a special guest.
Ooh.
We're going to have it. If I could get one person as a special guest on our podcast, our Ypres podcast, who would it be?
Craig Breen.
Freddie Loikes.
David?
Or Bruno Thierry. As
often, Loikes. George is right. Freddie Loikes.
Freddie Loikes.
He won Ypres 100 times.
Well,
literally.
He's won, I think it's something like, is it 11, 12 times, something like that.
Sure.
I've got his number in my telephone. Now, it's probably from about 10 years ago, so I'm hoping it's the right number. But I will make a commitment. Here's my commitment. We will have Freddie Loikes talking about the challenges of Ypres before we go to Ypres.
Yeah.
Well,
when I was thinking about Ypres, I was thinking about Condros Rally, which was always the one that we did at the end of the year
November.
Manager at Toyota, we would do Ypres. We would do Spa. Can't remember all the events. Spa, Ypres. Haspengouw. And sometimes the what was it the tour of. Something or other, I can't remember. Another event down in Dinan, Circuit of Dinan or something. Circuit of Ardennes. It was based in Dinan. Anyway, brilliant rallies. But Condros, we were using Rallycross. We were using Rallycross tires, proper.
But
proper
what I liked there was after Colin's great commitment to commitment. It was just a complete pause. Nobody believes it.
Honestly, let me double check. I have his number. I'm going to send him a note now.
I'm not disputing that you have Fast Freddy's number.
I've got Stefan Edberg's phone number in my phone, but he's not going to come on the podcast.
Yes.
Have you really?
Yes, and it ends in 1-2-2.
Let's do Fast Freddy next week and Stefan Edberg the week after.
I've already sent Freddy a text here, guys, so we'll see if he responds.
Oh, well done, Georgie. You're ahead of me. Good. Excellent.
Just
write the number. I suspect I've got the wrong one as well. So.
Right, we're done. I have to say, if you want to keep up to date with all things rally, then dirtfish.com is the place to go. Not just talking about the technology, not just talking about strategy, but talking about all the human stories that really keep us attached to this fantastic sport. Colin, David, George, thank you so much. I look forward to our pre-Ypres podcast.
Enjoy.